Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Hello and welcome to Talk Eastern Europe, a podcast dedicated to Central and Eastern Europe and the official podcast of the New Eastern Europe magazine. This is episode 126. My name is Adam Reichert, and with me is the other co-host of the podcast, Agnieszka Widłaszewska. Hi, Aga.
Hello, Adam. Hello, listeners.
So we are going to look at, I think, a very important topic, which we often cover here on the podcast, but I think the context has changed a lot, and the angle has changed a lot, and that is Eastern Partnership. Almost a year ago now, the question of the Eastern Partnership has been raised a lot, and whether or not the role of the European Union's project, which is called Eastern Partnership, makes any sense now that we have this aggression in Ukraine. We have Belarus, which is a country which we can say is supporting in some senses and some ways the aggression, Russian aggression. Moldova, which received the EU candidate status, Georgia, which has not, and then Armenia, Azerbaijan, which are also somewhere on the spectrum in terms of their relations to Europe, not to mention the fact that those two countries have an ongoing conflict between each other as well. So that's kind of a bit of a background on the topic that we're going to talk about today. But maybe before we go into that, is there any news, Aga, that you are following or any important updates since the last episode, which was published last week?
Yeah, I mean, I think the main thing, well, we are recording this on the 3rd of February, so it's Friday. And so the main thing this week that I have been looking at is the big trip of the European Commission to Kyiv, to Ukraine, where I believe it's 16 commissioners that went, led by Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission. And they are meeting, of course, President Zelensky and also of other officials. And there's like an official summit essentially taking place in Kyiv, which is the first time that such a summit is taking place in a war zone. So that's in and of itself quite significant. But I think at this point, the meetings are still ongoing. So we don't know yet exactly what are the conclusions, but presumably there might be some additional declarations when it comes to Ukraine, support for Ukraine, but also potentially some, in a way, cautious declarations when it comes to Ukraine's accession to the EU. From what I heard, there might be in the conclusions or in the declarations, there might be some kind of a message of it's not going to happen so soon, as soon as you might think. So we'll see a little bit maybe for next week's episode how the Commission decided to phrase its message.
Yeah, as we are recording, I think they just released the joint statement following the 24th EU-Ukraine summit. Unfortunately, we don't have Maciek with us anymore, who loved, I don't know if he loved it, but he would often analyze these statements and briefly summarize them for us. But we'll have to take a look at it. If there's anything important in there, we can bring you some information about it next week, as it was just released literally like 10 minutes ago, I see on the website. So
bad timing.
But I think you're right. It's very important that it took place in Kyiv. So that's also a huge, of course, symbol. I think there was, as the delegation was arriving, there were air raid sirens going off in Kyiv. So there was, it's a reminder of the reality that is facing Ukraine. And of course, the cooperation between the EU and Ukraine is going to be highlighted as Ukraine continues to deal with the aggression that's being faced in the country by Russia. As the war continues and as we are reaching the year anniversary of the invasion in February 24th, just in 20 or so days from now.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's quite important that this meeting happened in the kind of setting that it did. We will indeed see a little bit what are the consequences of it. But yeah, otherwise, I don't know if Adam, you have been following anything in particular or anything else.
No, I think there was just that one interview that Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia, gave just this week, where he made a comment that after Ukraine, Moldova will be next, to paraphrase. I think this is important just to keep in mind. It just shows also the attitude that Russia has towards its neighbors and its neighborhood, and that Moldova, a very small country, but still geopolitically very important, with a lot less capabilities than Ukraine has for defending itself. I think we also need to keep an eye on what's happening there. And Russia clearly is keeping its eye on Moldova and has some opinions towards it. So maybe in the near future, you know, there's been some political developments in Moldova, some developments, as I mentioned in the beginning, in terms of the European integration. There's been some developments. We haven't had an episode on Moldova, not recently, I don't believe. So maybe
no,
we will
I don't think so.
Look at that and look at doing one on that as well.
Indeed. It is quite interesting that the Russian side even feels like making such suggestions or threats.
Yeah.
Because they're really not doing very well. So I don't really understand why they feel like saying that, oh, we're going to do even more and we're going to invade even more countries and then get stuck there for years and years. So hopefully, of course, none of that is going to actually happen. And
yeah,
hopefully they get kicked out of Ukraine soon and don't get a chance to invade anybody else. But well, that happened. So we still need to keep an eye on this discourse.
Exactly. And there's, you know, another thing that is kind of quiet is Georgia. And just from some of the discussions I have with people there, there's a lot of disappointment with the Georgian government and how it has actually not built ties, but, you know, have kept some channels open with Russia despite the aggression in Ukraine. And I know a lot of Georgians are very upset, a lot of Ukrainians are very upset, and there was the whole development as well with recently former president Mikhail Saakashvili that was shown in very poor health, and even Zelensky himself was accusing Georgian government of having a role in the deterioration of Saakashvili's health. So that's also something I think we should be keeping an eye on as well.
Yeah, it's funny because we're talking about all these different issues, and this was actually also part of the interview that we're going to go into in a few minutes. But in one of my questions was about the challenges that the Swedish presidency of the Council of the European Union might be facing in the months to come. And Hugo, one of our guests, he essentially gave us this whole list and kind of a bit repeating what you were saying about these different countries, that basically in every single country in the region, there's an issue or there's some kind of a problematic situation or problematic relationship. And basically the EU kind of needs to try and manage all of it, or at least pick its battles and its priorities. So our listeners are going to hear more about that. And maybe with that, I'll give a brief introduction
yes.
to this interview and our guests, because this time we had two guests. So it's always quite interesting. And I actually thought that our guests this week had a very nice and very interesting dynamic. So I hope our listeners are going to like that as well, because then there's always a bit more, you know, energy in the interview.
Yes.
And
yes.
So, yeah, in general, this episode is co-produced with Forum Civ, which is an organization which unites about 200 member organizations from Swedish civil society. And they are also, their goal is to support civil society elsewhere. So they are active in about 70 countries in the world, and they support all sorts of initiatives. And they reached out to us to see if we would be interested in an episode that combines the topics of the, what I already mentioned, the Swedish presidency of the Council of the EU, which started on the 1st of January, with the topic of the Eastern Partnership, and specifically focus on civil society and its role in the Eastern Partnership countries and how it might look going forward, considering all the debates that we are having around the Eastern Partnership and what's going to happen with it. So that's kind of a bit of a background. And so therefore, my first guest was Ognjen Radonjić, who is a hub manager for Eastern Europe at the Forum Civ. So he kind of joined to give more of the civil society perspective. And our second guest was Hugo von Essen, who is an analyst at the Stockholm Center for Eastern European Studies. And so he talked a little bit more about the Swedish perspective and the Swedish priorities for the presidency, et cetera, et cetera. But it all kind of overlapped, as you're going to see. And so, yeah, I hope you enjoyed this interview and we'll see you afterwards for the outro.
Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, listeners. Welcome back to Talk Eastern Europe. This is Aga speaking, and with me are our two guests for today, Hugo von Essen and Ognjen Radonjić. Welcome to Talk Eastern Europe.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's great to have you both. And I'm really glad, actually, that Forum Civ, for which Ognjen works, reached out to me regarding this episode, because we have a lot of topics to cover, but I think they all overlap quite nicely. And I think it's going to be a really, really great discussion. So without further ado, I'm just going to jump straight into it. Although maybe a word of introduction first. So the motivation, in a way, behind this episode was the fact that Sweden recently took over the presidency of the Council of the European Union from Czechia. And in a way, it takes over, of course, during a very interesting time for the EU, but specifically for the EU's Eastern European policy, neighborhood policy, and also Eastern Partnership. Of course, because of everything that's been happening in Ukraine and around Ukraine. So that kind of ties the topic of the presidency with the topic of the Eastern Partnership and what is its potential future, or yeah, what's going to happen with it. And also, since Forum Civ is represented here, it would actually be also very interesting to talk about civil society specifically in this context and what is its role in the EU's Eastern European policy and the Eastern Partnership. So this is kind of the overview of what we're going to discuss today. And I'm going to start with Hugo in this context of the Swedish presidency. So like I said, Sweden took over from Czechia, and Czechia actually played quite a significant role in the development of the Eastern Partnership. And incidentally, Sweden has as well. And maybe you could tell our listeners a bit more what has historically been Sweden's role in the development of the Eastern Partnership as a framework.
Absolutely. Well, Sweden, as you said, has historically been active in the engagement with the region and in pushing EU cooperation further with the Eastern Partnership region. And in fact, the Eastern Partnership was initiated originally by Sweden together with Poland back in 2009, when Sweden last held the EU presidency. And many now see Sweden and Poland as kind of the parents of the Eastern Partnership. And now with Sweden having the EU presidency again, many people, let's say, have a lot of expectations as regards Sweden's role in developing the EAP further. And whenever me or my colleagues talk to people from the EU, from the region about the EAP, we hear all these questions about what will Sweden do now with the EAP? What new developments will Sweden push for? And I think it's important here to state that, of course, we are in a very different situation now in 2023 compared to back in 2009. And a lot has happened with the EAP, with the region, with the EU, and with Sweden since then. And we have a different government now in Sweden, of course. So I'm not so sure we can draw a lot of good parallels between Sweden's historical role in the development of the EAP and the current situation in the Swedish EU presidency in 2023. But of course, I think Sweden will continue, in, as it has done in the past, to push for further development of the EU's policy towards the Eastern Europe region and including the Eastern Partnership.
Okay, yeah, great. So yeah, it's good to keep it in mind that it had this role in the very beginning, and now it's sort of coming back at an even more important time for the region. And I'm wondering, has Sweden, I mean, it must have presented some kind of a platform or some kind of a plan for its presidency, but has it presented any concrete ideas or goals that are specifically related to the EAP or perhaps individual countries? I imagine they must have specific ideas regarding Ukraine, for example. And what can we essentially expect from the Swedish presidency in the coming months?
Right. So if we start with the Swedish presidency priorities, they, of course, have a lot to do with Ukraine. When you read through the big Swedish presidency program, basically every point starts with mentioning Russia's full-scale invasion and war against Ukraine and how this relates to whatever it is this particular section is talking about, be it security, development, trade, justice and home affairs, and so on. So, of course, Ukraine holds center stage here. And the first priority of the Swedish EU presidency is called security and unity. So it's this kind of duo that deals a lot with how to increase security of the EU, of Europe, of individual member states, but also, of course, how to support Ukraine, how to support European security beyond the EU, while also keeping EU unity, which of course has been the factor that has allowed the EU to implement all these sanctions against Russia and to support Ukraine. But actually the presidency program does mention the Eastern Partnership at one point. And it's this section that has to do with developments in the EU neighborhood, and that Sweden during its presidency will contribute to the efforts to foster closer contacts with relevant countries. And here mentions the Eastern Partnership as something that will be high on the agenda, and that Sweden will work for not only fostering closer ties between the EU and the Eastern Partnership countries, but also include strengthening the security dimension, which of course is something that is very, very important now in the current situation with the war. But then also beyond mentioning the Eastern Partnership, the presidency program also mentions individual countries. I mean, of course, apart from Ukraine, it also mentions Moldova and Georgia in light of the European Council's decision to grant candidate status to Ukraine and Moldova and to offer a European perspective to Georgia. And the presidency program here mentions that Sweden will, you know, continue to work for the EU integration of these countries and that the future of these countries lies in the EU and so forth. And then the EU also the program also discusses how to develop EU military operations further, utilizing the European Peace Facility. This, of course, has a lot to do with Ukraine, but you could also imagine that this could play a role in also security engagement of the EU beyond Ukraine in the Eastern Partnership, in the Partnership region. And here, for example, the program says that Sweden will contribute to strengthening the EU's role as a security actor, both in its neighborhood and globally, and so on. So to summarize, a lot of the priorities and a lot of the main points in the presidency program has to do with Ukraine, with supporting Ukraine in different ways, in various ways, militarily, security-wise, financially, and so on. And then the program also mentions the Eastern Partnership and mentions a couple of the countries in the Eastern Partnership. But I would say, to answer your question a bit bluntly, the Eastern Partnership does not play a major role here, unfortunately, and perhaps not as big a role as one would have wanted, I would say.
Well, we are, I believe, going to talk a bit more about the role of the Eastern Partnership and its future and how prominently or not it currently features on the different EU platforms. But yeah, I think it's very interesting what you're saying. And it's also interesting that Sweden is underlining the security and military aspect. And it shows us how much has changed, right? Even from several years ago, we've been saying for years that the EU is this soft power actor, right? And it doesn't really focus on the military and security. It's all about diplomacy and trade and economics. And now essentially even countries like Sweden are focusing on these more military and security elements. So yeah, we've come a long way, but unfortunately the circumstances have forced us to do so. But to turn more towards other areas, not just security and military, etc. Agnien, I was wondering, as I mentioned in the introduction, you are representing Forum SIF here, which is a major platform. I believe it's the biggest Swedish platform, right? The uniting civil society. So I was wondering if having the status, if you've had any chance to provide some kind of input during the preparation of the Swedish presidency, because I imagine the government usually consults different bodies, different organizations. And are there any specific civil society related initiatives that Sweden is planning to promote during its presidency?
Thank you, Aga. Indeed, we have. Going back a little bit history and repeating to what Hugo was saying, from the perspective of civil society, Swedish civil society has been engaged with Eastern Partnership countries since late 80s and early 90s. That interest faded a little bit in early 2000s due to lack of progress in reforms and in democratization as such, but was revamped since 2014. Maidan specifically. Most of the Swedish civil society working with their local partners are not necessarily dealing with issues of Eastern Partnership. The big political frames set by the Commission or bureaucrats and politicians far away don't necessarily touch them. However, we are a member of a Swedish civil society network for Eastern Partnership and Russia, a network that unites another 37 Swedish organizations working in the region. And through this network, we are channeling our views on the policy. This specifically means that we are trying to introduce values and principles of open society, of democracy, human rights, sustainable use of natural resources, gender equality into policies. And we are trying to work this both through Swedish Ministry of Foreign Affairs and through the Commission. I must say that Swedish Ministry of Foreign Affairs has been very active and has been very supportive and proactively listening to what we are saying. It's been quite a successful and fruitful cooperation for 9 years now since we have established the network. We have regular communication with the ambassadors as well as with the officers in the MFA. Currently, we are in this now 6 months period organizing a series of consultations in the countries, in each of the six countries. Well, Belarus will be a little bit different, obviously, but in the other five countries, as well as a big workshop in Stockholm somewhere in June, when we will be able to present to the MFA and the European Commission our findings.
Okay, that's great to hear. Very, very interesting stuff. Looking forward to hearing about it in the future as well, because I'm quite interested in what you're doing as well. I think it's very great. And now I wanted to come back a little bit to, in a way, the nature of being in charge of the presidency, chairing the Council of the EU. I think, Hugo, you mentioned a little bit the kind of what you talked about, the priorities and what Sweden will try to achieve. But of course, it's not that the fact that Sweden has the presidency that it can do whatever it wants. And a lot of the time, it's even very difficult to achieve certain things. So I was wondering, what kind of challenges do you see Sweden facing during its presidency when it comes to this EU, specifically EU's policy vis-a-vis the Eastern Partnership countries, Ukraine as well? What kind of issues do you see there potentially?
Right. So as you said, I think it's important to begin with the limits of the presidency, that as president, you can't do whatever you want. I mean, you have a big role of holding together the entire EU, keeping unity and so forth. So of course, that's an overall challenge. But if we speak specifically about challenges relating to the EU's policy vis-a-vis the countries of the EAP, of course, you have to start with the war, with Russia's ongoing full-scale invasion of Ukraine and all the challenges related to this. So, I mean, you could make the list long here, of course, but the most important are, you know, military and security support to Ukraine, financial, humanitarian support to Ukraine, and then eventually recovery and reconstruction of Ukraine. We have also now the newly established international multi-donor coordination platform since last week, and questions related to that, you know, how to find resources, how to mobilize private sector investment, etc. Then we also have Ukraine's EU integration, accession. We have the 7 recommendations from the Commission. We have now this interim oral spring assessment of the Commission of the progress here, which we don't have a date for yet, but which also will be very interesting to see what comes out of that. Then, of course, we also have the whole issue of sanctions vis-a-vis Russia, what new sanctions to implement, but also how to improve the implementation of the current sanctions, as Ukraine has been saying very clearly now that obviously products are still reaching Russia. Russia can still continue with its military industries. So how do we deal with sanctions busting through third countries like China, Kazakhstan, Georgia, and so on? And we also have the question of the related question of accountability for Russia as regards all crimes related to the war, but especially the tricky question of the crime of aggression, how to prosecute this, what type of court or tribunal, how to speed up the process, and so on. And all of these questions, we have a lot of different views from different countries in the EU. And then, of course, if we move on beyond Ukraine and the war, we also have a long list of challenges, other challenges in the Eastern Partnership region and as regards the EU's policy towards these. So, for example, we have Moldova, which is in a very, very critical, fragile, but I would say also promising situation where the EU can do a lot to support Moldova financially, politically, security-wise. We have this very good government right now in Moldova that is very pro-EU, very ambitious. But at the same time, you have all these crises in Moldova, security crisis, political crisis, economic, energy, so on. You have all these Russian hybrid threats, for example, protests, corrupt elites, Transnistria. You, of course, have all the negative consequences of the war also affecting Moldova very, very heavily. So here you have different challenges related to that, how to respond to that as the EU. And we have different ideas, such as a new EU CSDP mission to Moldova, for example, based on the EU assistance mission to Ukraine, which could work with security sector reform, strengthening police, strengthening resilience, so on. You could also talk here about EU integration and helping Moldova with capacity building to ensure fulfilling the Commission's recommendations to Moldova. Then if we move further away to Georgia, we have, as many people know, an extremely difficult situation, very difficult for the EU to know what to do here. We have state capture by a corrupt, basically pro-Russian government that is, you know, only taking the country further from EU. But you also have an opposition that is fragmented, not really getting its act together. And if you express it kind of harshly, this opposition is kind of waiting for the West to step in and save the day. And at the same time, you have a population in Georgia that is extremely pro-EU, And Russia is losing influence everywhere. So you have this golden opportunity of finally getting Georgia out of Moscow's influence and into Europe. So here I'd say you cannot really wait. So that's another challenge for the EU and for the Swedish presidency. And then moving further south from Georgia, we have Armenia and Azerbaijan, with also, of course, a very difficult situation with the conflict and all the related issues. And here things could, of course, become a lot worse at any time. But I would also say that EU probably could step up its efforts a lot here on mediation or conflict resolution. We have now a new CSDP mission to Armenia, which is a very good sign and development. And in the current situation with Russia busy with its war in Ukraine, losing influence, I think there's a very good opening for the EU to increase both its multilateral engagement in the South Caucasus and its bilateral relations and cooperation with both Armenia and Azerbaijan. And the question here for the EU is, should it let other countries fill the void left by Russia, such as Turkey, Iran, China, or should the EU take this opportunity, step in, and increase its engagement? So another challenge. And then, of course, we have Belarus, lots of challenges here, for example, related to sanctions, to Belarus' involvement in Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the threat and risk of Russia kind of forcing Belarus to take a more active role in the future, participating in the war. And also the question here of how to support Belarus civil society, both inside and outside of the country, and fight back against repression and so on. And then overall, of course, you have many challenges not related to a specific EAP country, but to the EU's overall approach to the region and all the various issues that I just mentioned. And in many of these issues, including support to Ukraine and to other countries, including EU integration and enlargement and EU engagement and security issues in the region, there is a great need for the EU to do much more. And here, the Swedish presidency could try to use its presidency to push the EU's position forward, to push the agenda in the right direction. But at the same time, there's also the very big issue of keeping the EU together, keeping EU unity in all of these questions of keeping all the different countries together to be able to do anything at all. And it's, like I mentioned before, it's this EU unity that has allowed for the sanctions against Russia and the support to Ukraine. And here Sweden sees itself very much as playing the role of honest broker, of kind of balancing and representing all the different countries in the EU and their views. But the problem here is that the goal of preserving EU unity is not always compatible with the goal of pushing the agenda forward, because many of the EU countries, of course, do not agree on whether or how to push the agenda forward on, for example, military support, Ukraine, EU enlargement, EU security engagement in the EAP region, and so on. So I would say that is a big challenge for the Swedish EU presidency, how to balance this, you know, pushing the agenda forward and all of these questions, while at the same time keeping unity together.
Right. In other words, tough times for right. Sweden and for everybody involved. That was indeed quite a list. It's also incidentally the kind of list that is interesting for us because it's essentially all the topics that we would like to cover on the podcast, all these different countries and what's happening there. So we are always struggling with choosing what to cover, how, when, because essentially all of these countries have so much going on at the moment, and it's all very important and it can have long-lasting consequences. So I think I'll just take this list that you gave us, and this will be like our next 15 episodes or something.
Perfect.
It's really good. But I think of course none of the presidencies can tackle everything in one go, because it's only 6 months, it's a very short period of time, and like we said, it's not even that the country holding the presidency can call the shots. So every country chooses in a way its battles, and then something might happen in the meantime that just, you know, kind of disrupts the whole agenda because you all of a sudden have to take care of something else. But hopefully at least some of these things Sweden will be able to bring to the fore. And now sort of to move a little bit away from the presidency itself, but to kind of go wider into the topic of the Eastern Partnership, and again focusing a little bit on the civil society here, I was wondering, Agnien, maybe you could tell us a bit more, what kind of support in general is civil society receiving through the Eastern Partnership framework? And perhaps you already told us a little bit about what Forum CIF is doing, but maybe you can tell us a little bit more about what you're doing in practice with the EAP countries as well.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino. Asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I'm listening to this Liz Hugo was mentioning, and I'm thinking that this could easily be a strategic plan for a decade or so for any civil society organization working in any of the countries in the region or with the countries in the region. To answer your question, what support Eastern Partnership has provided for civil society, it's a frame that channels a certain amount of funding from the European Commission towards civil society, both in the region as well as for cooperation in between European civil society and Eastern Partnership civil society. But what the most important value of the Eastern Partnership, and especially its civil society track, is the connections and the platform that created for exchanges in between civil society. And I think that was the most crucial part of it. The regional perspective, or how to say, Eastern Partnership is often seen as a relationship between Europe and its neighbors. However, within civil society, it is a lot more about relationships between the countries that are in the region. We have seen in this past decade, at least, that many of the authoritarian tendencies and tools are being translated. Belarusian law suddenly becomes a similar law in Azerbaijan. The narratives of Moldovan politicians suddenly becomes one in Georgia. And in this sense, as authoritarians are cooperating and copying and learning from each other, civil society has started learning and talking to each other. And this was this is a very, very important outcome of the Eastern Partnership. And for this reason, at least the civil society tract should be kept. There are many talks now what Eastern Partnership should be, whether the countries that got association agreements or should leave it or not. In my personal opinion, this civil society tract should be kept as is, specifically for this value. We have seen prior to Belarusian Revolution, Belarusians have been looking very closely to the Armenian Velvet Revolution, seeing that it is possible to change the government without causing geopolitical upheaval in the country. Obviously, it didn't work out for Belarusians as it did for Armenians, but it was a learning point. We see also now Belarus being involved in war in Ukraine, one way or the other, that the civil society there also needs to cooperate and communicate, especially with Belarusian civil society being exiled. This is a very critical point of cooperation and communication. Even before Moldovan and Ukrainian civil society would be working closely on environmental issues and so on. So this all was provided by the Eastern Partnership frame. What was the other question? I'm sorry.
Oh, it was specifically about Forum SIF, maybe what you do specifically in this context.
One thing that I've mentioned already, and sometimes this is a little bit more difficult for organizations on the ground, translating big policies and big words and declarations into day-to-day life. And for a youth organization in Gyumri or a women's organization in Kutaisi who is dealing with day-to-day battered women, what the European Commission says and what 20-something men and few women sitting around big tables somewhere are talking and writing doesn't really play out. So in this sense, our mission in a way is to translate both sides, what the politicians mean in their big words and how will that actually affect people on the ground, and to translate what people on the ground mean and what they want into the big policies. Sometimes we are able, sometimes we are not as good interpreters as we would want to be. Get lost in the translation a little bit.
I can imagine it might also be quite frustrating at times, but at least I'm sure you're trying your best, and whatever, you know, connection and understanding can be built is always, it's always valuable.
I would like also to add a little bit on this, if you don't mind. There is a whole range of issues that have started since 2020 with the pandemic, with the Belarusian revolution, with war in Armenia, and kind of a crown of it is Russian invasion of Ukraine. So we need to also be thinking through holistic lens when we are talking about the region. Obviously, war in Ukraine is overtaking everything, and somehow we are even forgetting other issues in the region and other happenings, call it, in the region that are still lingering around and that are still affecting lives of ordinary people and the work of civil society.
Yeah, I think that's very important. So thank you for that. And one element of your activities that I know, well, that I've read about a little bit, is that this Eastern Partnership network that you have is also meant to cover Russia, not just the Eastern Partnership countries in Russia. So I cannot help but wonder, how has the war affected this part of your work and this building of cooperation between civil society organizations in these countries?
It became extremely difficult, not only regarding to Russia, but in general. The obviously the war has affected everything and everybody in the region, not only civil society people as well as politicians. And there are so many stories and so many heartbreaking stories, even how it all turned. You have Belarusian activists who ran away from Belarus to Kiev, only a few months later to run from Kiev somewhere else, being a refugee twice in couple of months, an exile in couple of months, is no easy feature. Many Belarusians who found themselves in Ukraine have been treated with a lot of suspicion, even though they ran away from the dictatorship. They found themselves under scrutiny in Ukraine. Justifiable or understandable, but nonetheless painful. We have several partners now in Belarus who are working again with very daily things and daily supports of different marginalized groups and vulnerable groups that now have no access to medicine. You have, for example, parents of children with autism that cannot get medication because of sanctions and because of supply chains being disturbed. And then how civil society reacts in these kind of situations. They need to drop down from talking about policies, from changing laws, into basically providing humanitarian aid. When it comes to Russia, there is also quite a bit of suspicion, or might say exclusion, of Russian civil society. And again, maybe understandable, whether it's justifiable or not, it's not mine to judge. But there is a little bit of shunning of Russian civil society from the others, as they haven't done enough, or as they are equally responsible for the crimes of the regime. And this, in a sense, at least from my point of view of civil society, needing to be more open, more honest, and more inclusive than the rest of civil, the rest of society or the state, let alone politicians. It troubles me a lot. Not criticizing, I'm not judging, but it pains me.
Right, yeah. So in a way, the civil society could show some kind of an example or find a way to cooperate somehow or launch some new initiatives, new ideas. Yeah, I think we will still probably talk a little bit about it at the end of our interview. But now I, in a way, wanted to get to the elephant in the room, which is the general topic of the future of the Eastern Partnership as a framework. And here I turn to Hugo again, because, of course, Russia's invasion of Ukraine has resulted in so many unexpected developments in the region. Like we said, we already mentioned that Ukraine and Moldova received EU candidate status. Georgia applied for EU membership together with them and received a European perspective. There's these new ideas floating around, such as the European political community, different ideas. How do we now deal with the fact that part of this Eastern Partnership framework might join the enlargement countries, and then there's these remaining countries? What do we do? Basically, there's all these things flowing around. And I was wondering, what are your ideas or feelings? Is the Eastern Partnership going to be replaced by something else? Or if it stays, how could or should it be reformed? What can we expect here?
Well, it's the $1 million question, or $1 million questions in the plural, I'd say. But starting off, I think it's an interesting development that in the spring last year, after the start of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, a lot of people, both from the EU and from the EAP region itself, said that, well, now the EAP is finally dead. In these new circumstances, the EAP is irrelevant and so on. But now, soon a year later, the impression I have is that the general consensus has kind of shifted, done a 180-degree shift, and the EAP is now seen as instead very, very relevant. And of course, most people acknowledge all the well-known flaws of the EAP framework, such as the failure to include some sort of geopolitical ambitions and security cooperation in the framework out of fear of not provoke Russia and so forth, which obviously didn't work, we saw last year. Or another flaw is the lacking differentiation of the framework and trying to put all these very, very different countries in the same box with the same approach. Or the failure to acknowledge that many of the reforms the countries implemented turned out to be semi-reforms or fake or flawed reforms or reforms that easily could be undone later, such as the early frontrunner Georgia, which now has been backtracking for a long time. But at the same time, despite all of these flaws, many people now also see the great benefits that the EAP has brought and the strengths and, let's say, possibilities of the EAP and the many reasons why we cannot just throw away the EAP. And for one, it's partly, I'd say, thanks to the EAP that we are where we are, with Ukraine and Moldova receiving candidate status and Georgia membership perspective. The EAP has made possible a level of EU integration with these countries that then makes membership possible or takes them further, closer towards membership, including through association agreements and visa liberalization, etc. And secondly, the EAP has a lot of financial, judicial, technical processes that are not very easy to just discard or recreate. And if we did throw away these, probably soon someone would say, wait, shouldn't we have some regional format for cooperation with these countries? And then we'll have to kind of reinvent the wheel again under much more difficult circumstances. And thirdly, in this current geopolitical situation, with Russia losing influence all across the region and other actors trying to fill this void, I think it would be a very big mistake of the EU to remove the EAP and step away, even if we could try to replace it with something else. But however, as you mentioned in your question, we do, of course, have a completely new world now with Russia's war in Ukraine, with candidate status of Ukraine and Moldova, new formats such as the EPC. And I think in light of that, if we want to keep the EAP and want to keep it relevant, it must be reformed, transformed, or upgraded in some way to fit in with the new situation. And firstly, unlike previously, we should not see the EAP as the only or even main tool or framework for the EU's relations and cooperation with the region. I'd say rather it should be seen as one of many tools in the EU toolbox, including also bilateral relations, EU enlargement, EPC, and so on. And we should see it as the EAP filling certain functions and the other tools having other functions, and they kind of complement each other towards the same goal. And here I think it's secondly important to restate the goals of the transformed EAP, and the new goals should be, they must be geopolitical. It has to do with further decreasing Russian influence and increasing the EU's influence, improving the security, the prosperity and democracy in the region. And the question should be rather, how can the EAP A, increase the security against Russia in the region, and B, take these countries further towards EU integration and eventually EU accession? Because this was one of the major, or perhaps the major problem with the EAP previously, that it didn't have any clear goals, any clear end goals, either vis-a-vis Russia or as regards EU accession. So this would also be a way, I think, to deal with the issue of, for example, Ukraine not really seeing the value of the EAP for itself and so on. And then thirdly, I think we have to upgrade certain specific cooperation areas of the EAP. And I've already talked about regional security, but another one, as Ogden talked a lot about, is of course civil society cooperation, both within the region, between countries, but also between the region and the EU. Then I think you could also mention many other potential cooperation areas where the EAP could be where that framework could fill a major role, such as energy, climate, connectivity, so on.
I agree with you. Oh, I think, I don't know if Ognjen agrees with you, but I think he wants to say something about this.
I'm talking to you from sunny Belgrade. In November 2000, EU has issued first declaration committing itself to Western Balkans. Then in 2003, yet another one. Then in 2005, another one. And on and on and on, I have lost the count of how many summits, processes, tracks, declarations, partnerships have been issued, signed, evaluated. And in these 23 years, EU has lost any ability to influence any processes in the Western Balkans. Now, I don't want to sound here like a black crow of doom, but having this experience, I'm a little bit more skeptical on EU's ability to change or influence anything. Hugo did say that this is a different times now. Nothing like a good kick from behind to get people to think more creatively and be more proactive. And yeah, this is a kick to European security. But I am cautiously skeptical on EU's ability to actually create something new and enhance its influence in that region, or this one for that matter.
It's quite funny because, I mean, our listeners cannot see us, right? But up until now, Hugo had his camera off. But when Ognjen started his current comment, the camera went on. So I think the stakes are high right now.
Now, off the air, I did warn that I will turn skeptical eventually. I apologize. I'm a cynic by nature.
I don't think he minds. He looks quite content with this discussion. So, yeah, no.
I agree with a lot of what Ogden said, and I agree that, of course, the EU has enormous credibility issues, and that the Western Balkans experience and processes or non-processes shows that, demonstrates that very, very well. I see and hear and recognize and acknowledge Ogden's cautious skepticism. I would place myself slightly to the side, more as a cautious optimist, but leaning very closely to your skepticism. But as you said, Dong, I think the what could be the deciding factor here, changing everything and not ensuring that we not get another Western Balkans experience, I think is the war and all the consequences related to the war, such as, for example, Russia's decreasing influence and many EU countries finally seeing the seriousness of what's going on in that region. It could very well, unfortunately, turn out to be that you're entirely right. Let's have another episode in 5 years and see. I think there's a big
I would be very happy if I was wrong.
I'll hold you both to that. I'll put it in my agenda in 5 years, so we meet again and then we'll see. But maybe to try and wrap up on a kind of optimistic note, I hope, because I'm guessing, Ognjen, you are quite enthusiastic about civil society, so maybe you'll have like something positive to say on that. So I'm wondering, could civil society be the driver here of some kind of either revival of the Eastern Partnership framework or the creation of some new forms of cooperation? And what kind of initiatives would you like to see implemented? Something new, something to, you know, spice things up here.
Civil society from the region can be drivers, and they have been drivers, at least of this civil society track of it. They have been drivers and strong supporters of Eastern Partnership initiative. Some more than others. Obviously, those who have bigger need, as again, Belarusians or Armenians, would be bigger drivers than, say, Ukrainians or Georgians and Moldovans. But nonetheless, I've said already that the great value of the initiative was that this civil society was able to talk to one another. And in this sense, they can be a driver they can be an input, but political decisions are made by politicians. And politicians and, by extension, bureaucrats in the commission and the ministries need to start doing their job or continue doing their job. Civil society is there to keep them on the track, to keep them on the straight and narrow, to give any kind of input. And a little bit of pressure, but it is them who need to step up.
All right. Decision makers, you've had Ognjen. Go and work on it now. No, but this is, thank you both, honestly, for this discussion. And I love the interaction here. I think it's always way more interesting. And of course, it's not a black and white topic. I mean, I think we are all aware of this, that there's a lot to be said, both positive and negative, about the Eastern Partnership framework. But for now, it is still around. And I have a feeling there will be some attempts to reform it. The question is how and what's going to happen. So maybe not even in 5 years, maybe a bit earlier, we will get a chance to speak again and see where we are. So once again, Hugo and Ognjen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Aga.
Thank you very much.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from, with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
And that was Agnieszka's interview with Hugo van Essen and Ognjen Radonjić about the Swedish presidency and the Eastern Partnership, as well as a strong focus on civil society in the region. Agnieszka, thanks so much for this interview. Curious if you had any reflections after the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I think the main reflection, I'm sure our listeners have seen that as well and heard that as well, is that there is in a way no one way for the Eastern Partnership. And there's also not one view on the extent to which it was beneficial or not, and as to whether it was well done or not. There's certain things that were really well done, that where it has contributed to a lot of good things. As our guests mentioned, it has really provided this platform for cooperation, not just between the EU and the Eastern Partnership countries, but also among the Eastern Partnership countries. And yeah. I kind of think that this might be even more important in the beginning. And we need to remember that Eastern Partnership is still a relatively young initiative, because it was only launched in 2009. So, I mean, it's less than 15 years old. And so perhaps in the beginning, it might be even more important to have to build these relationships between these countries where they are still kind of developing, they are still figuring themselves out, they are still trying to find their path. So if they can work together on certain things, if they can share best practices amongst each other, knowing also each other's problems and understanding each other's problems because they are experiencing them at the same time, I think that might be even more beneficial than just the EU, for example, coming with its own guidance or with its own rules and things like that. Because
exactly,
I think Ognjen was also talking about it, how sometimes, you know, whatever the EU comes up with in terms of policies, it's not like it can be directly translated just like that into implementation on the ground, because a lot of the times the circumstances are such that it's just not very possible, or the needs are actually different. And the other way around as well, what the beneficiaries on, or let's say civil society organizations or actors on the ground might need, does not always translate into these policies at the high level. So sometimes there is a bit of this disconnection, but at the end of the day, there is a lot of good that has come out of the Eastern mm-hmm. Partnership. And I think the conclusion was that it's likely that it will remain, you know, present as an initiative, but it might, or most likely will be reformed somehow.
Yes, yes.
because it has to adapt to the current circumstances, to the fact that some of the countries that are part of the EAP will now also be part of the enlargement negotiations and the enlargement process, but they will still, of course, remain physically within the same region. So there are still, in a way, there is a reason to maintain this cooperation between these EAP countries, but you will have to adjust to the fact that they are not at the same level, that they don't have the same level of ambition, and it cannot be just a one for all type of mechanism. Right,
exactly. Yeah, it has to be tailored exactly for the different countries. I completely agree. And I also agree that, as you mentioned, this multilateral dimension, as they call it, of the Eastern Partnership, where the countries are cooperating amongst each other and kind of supporting each other, I think is a really important aspect and dimension of Eastern Partnership, which I think in some ways has not always gotten the credit that it deserves, and often reminds me of, you know, Visegrad cooperation that took place in the 90s between Poland, Hungary, and Czech Republic. Slovakia was a part of that for most of the 90s. As we mentioned in two episodes ago, there were some issues there. But, you know, the important, my point here is that the important part is that these countries, you know, are trying to drive the process themselves. I think it has to be driven from the countries themselves more than top down from the EU. And that, I think, is exactly some of what you talked about as well during this interview.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I think it was Hugo who mentioned, and it's true that in a way, the fact that Ukraine and Moldova received this EU candidate status last year and Georgia received its membership perspective, it is in part thanks to the fact that the Eastern Partnership existed beforehand.
Yes,
to
yes.
prepare them at least partially to kind of make them used to this close cooperation with the EU, to give them the opportunity to advance on certain things that they could advance on at one point or another. So if there had never been any format such as this one, the situation would have been most likely very much different. So I think this is something that we sometimes might forget about or ignore. I think the EAP has been a bit of a scapegoat for quite some time, but credit where credit is due, I think
yes.
there has been some really positive things that have come out of it. So it remains to see what the EU and the EAP countries respectively are going to do with it, whether there will be this willingness to continue and in which format. And we already kind of decided. We said with Hugo and Ognjen that it would be great to meet, you know, in 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, and sort of see what has changed since this conversation that we had now.
Absolutely. And yes, this conversation will be part of the archive of the evolution of Eastern Partnership. I think we're kind of in the middle of it. So it's definitely will be coming back, I think, to both our guests and following up on the developments.
And I think with that, unless you have anything else, Adam, we can just move on to our regular
yep.
announcements.
Sounds good.
Oh, and guess what? I forgot once again to mention my disclaimer in the intro. So I'll do it in the outro.
Okay.
But never mind. I'll start then. Well, just in case you were wondering, none of my opinions and anything that I say on this podcast represents the interest of the institution that I work for. And we talked about this institution today. So especially just don't take anything that I say as their opinion or whatever their view. But yeah, other than that, I think just our regular announcement. So please, please do get in touch with us if you ever feel like it, if you have any comments, if you just want to say hi. We are both active on Twitter. We also have our special dedicated Facebook group, Talk Eastern Europe Podcast. So join us there. We always post some updates there and new episodes and all that. And we have our website, which is talkeasterneurope.eu. We have a contact form there as well. So you can even send us messages via this website. Again, you can find all our episodes there. And yeah, and just in case you like us, tell somebody about us, recommend us also on social media, or give us rating, a review. It's always very, very nice for us to have such support from you.
That's right. We love to hear from you. So please do contact us wherever you can find us. Maybe we'll, I don't think we've done this so often before, but maybe we'll put our Twitter handles on the notes for this podcast just so you can
tweet
find
at us.
Yes, you can tweet at us or just Google us. I'm sure you'll find us quite easily. But I also wanted to add that what really helps with the podcast, if you like the podcast and if you've been listening to us for a while, give us a 5-star rating on whatever app that you're using. And as Agnieszka said, please, feel free to recommend us to your friends and family. Maybe you have, third cousin twice removed who was very interested in what's happening in the region of Eastern Europe, and you can recommend to him or her that that Talk Eastern Europe podcast is a great resource.
And now all the Brits are like, oh, I know what is the third cousin twice removed, and everybody else is like, what?
Yeah, it's a very Anglo-Saxon expression. That's true. I'm not exactly sure if I know, but it does exist from what I'm told. So and I'm sure that one listener out there has that distant relative who should be listening to Talk Eastern Europe. So please find a way to get them into our community. And speaking of communities, we have, for those who are really passionate about this podcast, as passionate as Agnieszka and I are, we do have a Patreon page, so you can support us and provide financial support for the podcast, which is used, for us to buy, to upgrade our equipment. We have to maintain things like our website. We have to pay for services where we get, the music and the jingles from and all that. So that all costs money. And as our longtime listeners know, that this podcast is a labor of love. We do not have additional funding for this podcast at the moment, at least, to support it. So the patrons are basically, let's say, sponsors, which help us run this podcast and to help us promote it and be as successful as we believe that it is. And of course, we don't just take money from our patrons. They also get some excellent benefits, including discounts on new Eastern Europe products, access to digital archives, as well as we have a nifty water bottle. So,
which I am still waiting for, but I don't know if that's because of you or because of the Belgian Post. So I'm not going to say
it's... Yeah, let's blame it on the Belgian Post for the moment. I have mine, so I can do a screenshot later and show it
off in front of me.
But it's a great bottle, and it's just one of the several benefits that we offer for our podcast patrons. Of course, there is the one and only podcast shout out, which we have been doing since we've started the Patreon page back in, I would say, 2019. I think it was probably April or May when we launched the Patreon page. And we say a special thank you to our patrons who are supporting us in the $5 and above range, and or our long time, who have been with us for a long time. And Aga, I don't know, I think you did the last week shout out, so maybe you'll allow me to say...
Yes, I will allow you to
thank
have
you.
This
well,
honor.
So I just want to say thank you. We, on behalf of the co-hosts, say thank you and hello to our patrons: Daniel, Juraj, Luke, Susie, David, Daniel, Carolina, Percy, RSJ, Michael, Anais, Olaf, CB, Klaus, Plum and Sean, Naomi, JP, Elise, Sean, Urs, Ian, Sophia, Wilhelm, David, Erica, Janos, Jason, Mark, Stephanie, and Pierre. Thank you so much for your support. It really does mean a lot for us, and we have some special additional meetups coming very soon. One that we are planning, which will be around the anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. So please stay tuned for that. And I know that some of you have, unfortunately, unlike Agnieszka, I know that some of you have already received the bottle, and I hope you're enjoying it. Sorry, Aga, I'm going to have to resend it because the Belgian Post somehow misplaced it.
Lies. Anyhow, yeah, thank you so much to our patrons, and thank you so much to all of you listeners. We can see that you are still around with us after the Christmas break because we check our stats. So thank you so much for coming back to us in 2023. And we hope that you enjoy the content and the podcast, and we are looking forward to bringing you even more content from Eastern Europe and other areas around it.
Yes, so thanks a lot for joining us and stay tuned.
Talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.